Okay, we're back in Psalm 78. Psalm 78. Can we close last week down around verse 58? Let me go back for context. And it says, yet, talking about Israel in the wilderness. This is one of the long chapters of the Lord's summary of how things went. It's interesting to go back and get his assessment. He says, verse 56, yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God and kept not his testimonies, but turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places. We closed talking about high places last time. It's a weird thing, but the devil wanted to be above God, and all these folks then, flocked to high places to go after their idols. When you see these great spires and all these things on these temples and cathedrals and all that stuff, that's just a salute somehow to a fallen spiritual entity that influences men to desire high places. It's kind of strange, but it's one of those things that it's the way men are, right? Anyway, it goes on to add, after talking about the high places and moved him to jealousy, you'll notice with their graven images. And so, again, just plain old-fashioned idolatry. And I wanted to pick up a thought here. Look in Jeremiah chapter 50. Jeremiah chapter 50. And there's a whole strain in the scriptures of with idolatry and false prophecy and false religion, there comes this other strain of something in. We know this strain exists from sin. We'll talk about it in just a second. But in Jeremiah chapter 50, going down to verse 37. Now he's talking about the Chaldeans from verse 35, the inhabitants of Babylon. And he talks about a sword is upon the liars in verse 36. A sword is upon their horses, verse 37. Upon their chariots and upon all the mingled people that are in the midst of her. And they shall become as women. A sword is upon her treasures and they shall be robbed. So he's judging Babylon. And it says this. A drought is upon her waters and they shall be dried up. For it is the land of graven images and they are mad upon their idols. I mean, they're mad, not angry mad, but a little crazy. Now what that connects is a connection with false religion, idolatry. And if you move it to the New Testament where covetousness is idolatry, then you kind of have to apply it that way too. You've probably known folks that, you know, while they may not bow down to some idol in a grove somewhere, worship at a Catholic church and genuflect and pretend that Mary's bleeding or something like that, that they're still a little crazy in that religion, that it almost takes over their mind. That the case, don't you know people that are like that with a career or money or something in, some people aren't just football fans. I mean, they are football fans. And I'm saying where that is life. I mean, they just don't follow the Vikings or the Packers or whatever, but I mean, they're fully into a fantasy football and are betting money right and left and all this kind of stuff. Okay, what is that? I kind of don't get it. I mean, I get it in that I know it's true, but I've never had the money to gamble, you know? And there's a madness to it, is all I'm saying. There's a connection here with false religion, with idolatry, and things that you could count as idolatry. There's a certain madness that set in. We were just in Luke 15 on Sunday, the prodigal son, and that son went off in sin, right? In a far country in sin, and then he had to come to himself before he was willing to go back and get right. There's a certain madness to sin. Now, haven't you experienced that? Haven't you ever had something get a hold of you? And all you wanted to do was that thing? You know, for some it's, I don't know. You say, well, it's dope, or it's sports, or it's this, or it's that, or it's, video games, where literally if you're not careful, it almost takes over part of your life. Okay, you're not quite in your right mind at that time, are you? Haven't most of you been experienced enough at sin to know that if you're not careful, it's really easy to turn control over to those things? Notice another connection here with this madness. Just let me track this for just a minute. Not too long, but again in chapter 51, verse 7, I mean, still in Jeremiah, Babylon has been a golden cup in the Lord's hand. Now, most of us don't have any problem prophetically linking that with the Roman Catholic Church and a future judgment there, right? That made all the earth drunken. That's what the great whore of Babylon does, right? Notice, the nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. Now, you think of all that's wrought in false religion. Take the Catholic Church or take Islam. And when you study it, those folks are kind of nuts. I mean, they're kind of crazy in those religions, aren't they? Look, if you will, as we just move on down here for a little bit, go to Hosea chapter 9. I won't run too many of these, but I'm simply pointing out that there is a theme that wins its way through false prophecy, false religion, idolatry passages that links a certain madness, kind of a loss of sanity in some ways. Hosea chapter 9, if you will, go on down to verse 7, Hosea 9, 7. The days of visitation are come. That's not Saturday visitation, by the way. That's the Lord coming in judgment. The days of recompense are come. Israel shall know it. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is mad for the multitude of thine iniquity and the great hatred. It says there that a spiritual man, probably a false prophet, is mad. Look, if you will, in Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. I mean, haven't you ever, I mean, we talk about it a lot, but we say, and I say all the time, that people in the country are kind of nuts right now and have been for a while. But, you know, when you take off and you start worshiping the environment effectively, where all of your time is consumed with making sure you're green enough, or, you know, when you adopt some whack-brained cause, you know, haven't you ever known somebody in some cause somewhere that's so far into it that they're a little bit wonky? what's going on there? It's somebody that's given themselves over to something. If it's not, you know, what we normally think of as idolatry or, properly speaking, religion, it's still true that you can give yourself over. And, you know, a Bible believer should have his mind and heart on following the Bible, trying to win somebody to Christ and know God better day by day. And once you get beyond those things, I mean, you have responsibilities, you have family and all that, and once you start turning that over and where, you know, the next gambling excursion up to Hinckley, you know, is what's always on your radar. You know, you're depressed when you get back on Monday, but boy, just can't wait to get back up there on Friday. You know what I'm saying? Don't you know people like that with sports? Don't you know people like that with careers? Don't you know people like that with partying? And they get a little nuts. There's a spiritual element to that. Luke chapter 6, and the Lord Jesus Christ heals this guy on a Sabbath, I think. The Son of Man, verse 5, is the Lord also of the Sabbath. And looking round about him, upon them all, verse 10, he said unto the man, stretch forth thine hand. He's going to heal this guy. And he did so, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And they, that is, those folks standing round about, were filled with madness. Here's Jesus Christ that does a miracle in front of them, and they're so deep into Phariseeism, Sadduceeism, and whatever comes with the scribes, the scholasticism, that it fills them with madness that he's done this. How dare he do this and break up our system? There's a certain madness to it. That's why it said the prodigal son had to come to himself. Look, if you will, real quick, just a couple more. if I can see my note, Acts 26. Paul confessed it. Acts chapter 26. Acts 26. Now here's Paul, the great inquisitor. He is a Pharisee of the Pharisees before he gets saved, and he is tormenting and torturing people out of their faith. He is letting people hear their kids scream as he tortures them so that they'll give up Jesus Christ. He says, verse 11, I punished them oft in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme, and being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even in the strange cities. Now, again, that's not angry. He may have been angry, but he's not talking about angry here. He's talking about a little bit nuts, right? One more. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. Now, here's a guy that's got a blank check in his pocket from the king of Moab, and he is trying to figure out a way to get a chance to write the figure in. And King of Moab has promised him anything he wants if he'll just come do one thing. And the Lord won't let him do the one thing, but he'll figure out something. But it says this in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 15, talking about wicked men, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam. The way of Balaam has to do with the wages of unrighteousness at the end of the verse. Is that right? The son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. Now, the love of money is the root of all evil. Doesn't say that money is the root of all evil. But the love of it is. And it's hard not to love it once you start pursuing it. It's hard, right? It's an issue we deal with every day. It goes on to add in verse 16 that being the case, but he was rebuked for his iniquity, the dumb ass speaking with man's voice. I mean, think about that, a donkey rebuking you. The donkey speaking forbade the madness of the prophet. Here's the prophet, and God said no. But there's a blank check in his pocket that says yes. And so he's debating this whole thing all the way through. And by the time it's over, the donkey rebukes his madness. I only say that to say that if you're wondering why the world is nuts, it's because they're off on tangents. They're serving idols of mind and heart, if not actual idols here. And so that's why you see kind of craziness in religion. And that's why you see craziness in people predicting weird stuff. And so on and so forth. Anyway, back to Psalm 78. Psalm 78. Okay, they provoked him to anger, verse 58, with their high places, and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. When God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel. He was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel. Now, Israel is his people. And he loved Israel and loves Israel. So at the same time, that's the trace. He still greatly abhorred Israel. Technically, it looks to me like those two things can abide side by side. God still loves somebody, but he might abhor them. To abhor means to regard with horror or loathing, or disgust, or repugnance. It's possible for God to love somebody, like he did Israel, and be repulsed and feel a repugnancy towards what they're doing. That's what abhor means. So technically speaking, it's not exactly the same as hate. See what I'm saying? So there's not a contradiction. Verse 59, when God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel. It's not a too far stretch to say that that's how he feels about the Laodiceans and Revelation 2, Revelation 3. Because, you know, he hated what they were doing, and he hated it so much, and he was so repulsed by it that he, you know, spits them out of their mouth. He's out of his mouth, right? Because they're lukewarm. But it's an abhorrence, a repugnance. In verse 60, so he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among them. So the Lord brings the children of Israel into the land. They, of course, are coming in with the ark and the tabernacle and so on. And so what happens is, if you will, just let me take you through just a quick swath here. Look in Joshua chapter 18. They come into the land and they set up. The Lord has not yet pointed out Jerusalem as the place where his sanctuary will be. So in 18:1, the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of the congregation. Shiloh was the first place. That was kind of the first sanctified holy place that Israel honored. And the God let them set up the tabernacle there in Shiloh. Shiloh was the place for a while. Okay, as you move on through the passage, the passages with connecting these things together, Samuel, and during Samuel's day, under Eli, that's where the tabernacle was parked. The ark was parked there in Shiloh. So then they take the ark into battle, correct? And the ark is captured by the Philistines. And so the Philistines finally have to get rid of it. It goes to Kirjath-Jearim, where it sits for 20 years because the men of Beth-Shemesh looked into it, peered into it, and died. Is that right? So it goes there for 20 years. So it's out of place. It's not in Shiloh anymore. Eventually, David says, we need to bring this back. But the first time he tried, he didn't do it the right way. And Uzzah reached up and touched it and died. And so it goes to the house of Obed-Edom, where it is until David figures out the mistakes that they made. And so by the time that happens, David takes the tabernacle into Jerusalem, sets up the tabernacle, and it's no longer in Shiloh. But Shiloh was that first holy place. And it was the parking place of the tabernacle and for the ark for a while. And finally, of course, Solomon comes along and builds the temple. And Solomon set then the ark in the temple. And that's where it was then from then on. Now, it kind of disappears. 2 Chronicles 35. I ran through all that just to say that you remember the Raiders of the Lost Ark, probably, right? Or are you all too young for that? 2 Chronicles 35 is because nobody's quite sure what happened to it. 2 Chronicles 35. And this is about the last time it's mentioned, unless I'm mistaken. 2 Chronicles 35 and verse 3. This is during Josiah's day, verse 1. Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. He set the priests in their charges and encouraged them in the service of the house of the Lord, and said unto the Levites that taught all Israel, which were holy unto the Lord, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, did build. It shall not be a burden upon your shoulders. Serve now the Lord your God and his people Israel. And it looks like something happened there where by Josiah's day, the ark was back out somehow of the tabernacle, of the temple, and he had to order them to bring it back in. But that's the last time you have that ark mentioned. And so thus, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, because it disappeared somewhere. And there was a whack brain archaeologist here a few years back that was still teaching that it was brought eventually into a cave under Calvary. And when Christ died on the cross, the blood of Christ dripped down the pole and went down into the ground and dripped on the mercy seat of the actual ark. And I think that's nonsense. Okay, we don't know what happened to it. We don't know exactly when it disappeared. Like I said, it disappears here in 2 Chronicles 35, late in Josiah's career. So he's one of the last kings. The only thing we can say is this. Turn to Revelation chapter 11, and you can speculate a little from here, and maybe it's crazy speculation, maybe it's not. Revelation chapter 11, and go on down to verse 19. This is in heaven. Verse 15, the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. That's the millennium setup, right? Go on down in verse 19. And the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament. And there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail. So either and this is very possible, either the ark on earth was a pattern and copy of the ark that has always been in heaven, or else the ark that was down here was raptured out and taken to the temple in heaven, and here you get to see it in Revelation chapter 11. So I don't know. It's possible it was raptured out. But Indiana Jones didn't have nothing to do with it. That's all I know. All right, back to chapter 78, verse 60. So he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh. Again, that history, Shiloh was the first real holy place, and Samuel did a little route there for a while, and then as history progressed, we kind of lose track of what happened with the ark exactly, and I guess we weren't intended to know, at least not at this point. The tent which he placed among them, among men. Verse 61, and he delivered his strength unto captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. I think he's referring to his strength being the ark, or his people, and his glory into the enemy's hand. It sure looks like that when the ark was taken by the Philistines in that battle, that God's glory was among them. Looks like that's what that verse means. He gave his people over also unto the sword, and was wroth with his inheritance. Verse 62. His inheritance is Israel, so he's wroth with them. He abhorred them, he's wroth with them. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword. Their widows made no lamentation. They're surrounded by so much sorrow that, you know, somebody's husband gets killed, and that's just the way of war, and you just have to just kind of go on, kind of numb. You have no more tears to cry. Verse 64, their priests fell by the sword, their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord waked as one out of sleep, and like a mighty man that shouteth by reason of wine. Now exactly where that happened, one exact juncture in history, I don't know if there's one exact juncture. A lot of times God did judge his people and then let them go through it for a while, and then he would rise and smite their enemies and that sort of thing. So I don't know if that's just one time. But verse 65, it's a picture of the second coming of Christ. Then the Lord waked as one out of sleep, and like a mighty man that shouteth by reason of wine. So it's like he's drunk, only he's not drunk. And he comes back angry, just screaming. Look in Isaiah chapter 42. Isaiah 42. Like they say, one day Jesus is coming again, and boy, is he mad. He'll come get us out of here lovingly and gather his bride together, but he's coming back angry at the nations. Isaiah 42. Go down to verse, if I can find it, verse 13. The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. I have long time holding my peace. I have been still and refrained myself. Now will I cry like a travailing woman. I will destroy and devour at once. Now, you know, a travailing woman having a baby, you know, everybody's seen it on TV. If you have not been fortunate enough to be in the room where your babies were delivered, maybe you've never heard it. Not in real life, but they do yell. And, you know, to think of the Lord coming back, that is a little strange, but enough anger, right? Look, if you will, at another passage like this, Micah 1. It's another picture of the Lord coming back and what it'll be like. Micah chapter 1. Micah chapter 1. Lord's angry with them in verse 7 about their graven images. All the graven images thereof shall be beaten to pieces, and all the hires thereof shall be burned with the fire, and all the idols thereof I will lay desolate. For she gathered it of the hire of a harlot, they shall return to the hire of a harlot. Therefore I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the dragons and mourning as the owls. He's coming forth so angry, just screaming like a travailing woman. That's the second coming of Jesus Christ. Back to Psalm 78. Psalm 78. Verse 65. Then the Lord waked as one out of sleep, like a mighty man that shouteth by reason of wine. He's not drunk, but that might be what it, you know, almost looks like. He's so angry, not out of control, but maybe he looks out of control. We're talking about God here, right? Verse 66, and he smote his enemies in the hinder parts. He put them to a perpetual reproach. And that hasn't happened permanently yet, but it will. 67, moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph and chose not the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved. And, you know, there was a time in history where he hadn't chosen that yet, and so they had their temple at Shiloh. But, you know, he's now chosen Jerusalem. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the lawgiver from between his feet. And so the Lord chose Judah for the place. And he says, verse 69, and he built his sanctuary like high palaces, like the earth which he had hath established forever. So that temple then, that sanctuary was built in Jerusalem. And it says that he built his sanctuary like high places. Now, this kind of goes back to the tabernacle thing. Look real quickly with me, and this will be the last thing tonight. Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8. And that whole tabernacle slash temple set up, all the furniture, all of the ordinances, and, you know, all the building, all the infrastructure was built around something that's in heaven. Look in Hebrews chapter 8. And notice the Lord's talking about the priesthood here, and he says, verse 4, for if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law. Notice who serve, earthly priests, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God. So the priests, the Levitical priests down here, served unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. What was down here was a shadow of what was up there. Look, if you will, in chapter 9, verse 11. No, let's go earlier, where all this stuff that these guys were doing. Let's start with verse 8. The Holy Ghost thus signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing, which was a figure. So the first tabernacle was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience, which stood. So all these ordinances stood only in meats and drinks and diverse washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of reformation. Oh, there's a time that changes this over. Verse 11, but Christ being come and high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle. In other words, the real things in heaven, what was down here was just a shadow, a figure of the real thing. And so quite literally, you know, Jesus Christ, when he ascended, he did something on the altar up in heaven. And the real stuff is up there. Everything that was down here was just a pattern. It was a pretty glorious pattern at one point. By the time Solomon's day rolled around, that was a sparkling, glimmering, glorious pattern. But it doesn't touch heaven. look, this is hinted at yet some more, where it says at the end of verse 11, a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, because something up there is real. Verse 9:23. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these. So the stuff down here was the pattern. So the Lord, you know, sprinkled goat's blood and bullock's blood and all this kind of stuff down here to cleanse the patterns of the things that are real in heaven. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands. He didn't enter down here, not in an active a way that mattered, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. All that's to say is the real things up there. So nothing you ever enjoy down here will be complete. It's always going to be a fallen figure, a fallen shadow. Amen? All right. Let's, I guess, sing one more.